You're listening to Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Robert Cantor is one of the world's most recognised international recovery and family advocates, addressing the opioid crisis. From personal experience, he's able to bring a wealth of knowledge and hope to this ongoing crisis and the effect that the pandemic has had on those suffering. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from, I believe, New York, Robert Cantor himself. Robert, good afternoon from me. Good morning to you.
Good afternoon, Giles. It's an honor and privilege to be on your program. Yes, I am speaking to you from New York. Thank you for, thank you really for giving us the airtime. And, as I'll speak in terms of trying to reverse a prolific epidemic, we must have the media consistently covering the topic and as much as we can, disseminating information for people to have the tools and also understanding the severity of the opioid epidemic and what they can do about it. To have a real top of mind awareness, the media is critical. And so thank you for allocating time for me to speak and for information for your listeners.
So tell me a little bit about, because there is a personal aspect, isn't there? So for those who don't actually know you or know your work, give me a little bit of background, if you will.
Sure. So I am in recovery from what we call politically correct now, alcohol use disorder and substance use disorder, or we abbreviate it SUD. The reason we change the language is because we change the narrative to address the stigma. We don't use those other words, and actually we won't even use them on the air, Giles, but we don't use the words we used to use because it stigmatizes an individual that is suffering from an illness. Just like any other illness, cancer, diabetes, it's an illness, and we really need to come from a place of compassion and love and understanding and give them what's called harm reduction tools, which you actually do very effectively in Spain. So that's what I suffer from. My daughter also suffers from opiate use disorder. And, I won't go into what they call the war stories, but I will tell you that I lived the unspeakable. I was told when you talk about the shame, you take the power out of it. So during my time on the streets, I lived in crack houses, shooting galleries, S&M dungeons. I could go on and on. But I came crawling into a 12-step abstinence-based program in 1992, I followed the tenets of the program. My life became a lot better and then decided to stop going to those meetings and relapsed Christmas Eve 2002 and would come back Christmas Eve 2005 to the day. There were multiple emergency room visits. I think I stopped counting at 11 and rehabs and all the insanity that goes along with using those substances. And so I'm in my 16th year of sobriety, and besides my life becoming a wonderful life and being able to provide service like this is a form of service that I'm speaking to you, I was able to be a power example for my daughter. And there was one incident or one event that was a turning point that brought me from my recovery to my advocacy work. My daughter hit a bottom with heroin use, heroin and opiates, locked in an apartment, not coming out, not communicating with my wife and I, with a drug-dealing boyfriend who was feeding her drugs for free, and she was killing herself. And I'm certain that if we had not had a conversation with her, she would have overdosed. I mean, there's, the amount that she put in her system, she was 24 at the time, she's petite, there's no question in my mind. So in the past, I came from a place of stigma and punishment. We're going to punish the problem away. You have no willpower. You're a loser. You're not part of this family. And I had heard about something called the Portugal model, in which the country of Portugal reduced their heroin epidemic by 75% by taking the problem and not addressing it in their legal system, but putting it into their Ministry of Health, having an individual meet with what's called a dissuasion committee of a physician, a social worker, and an attorney. And they worked with that individual, giving them harm reduction tools. They met the individual understanding that they had an illness. So I said to my wife, we need to change this up. We need to have a loving, destigmatized conversation with our daughter. And so we convinced her to come to a diner in New York. She showed up to the diner high, but she came. And she heard the unexpected. We told her we love her, that we had her back within our boundaries. Don't get me wrong. She's not going to come over and, you know, and take opiates and snort cocaine and watch Netflix. That we're not talking about. But we wanted her to meet. We wanted to meet her where she was, not where we wanted her to be. We said, we understand your suffering. You're in pain. We do love you. You are part of the family. We're willing to drive you to detox right now. It's up to you. So she left the diner, and we didn't know what was going to happen. You know, we sat there, we cried, my wife and I, and miraculously an hour later, she showed up with all her belongings in a black garbage bag, and we drove her to detox, and then she went on her own to rehab, to a 28-day program, then to a sober living facility, and now is in a healthy relationship and has a job and is working on her third year of sobriety. So both my daughter and I have experienced this miracle of sobriety. And I said, let me do some volunteer work for a nonprofit in New York City. And one thing led to another and led to another. And I was invited to a press conference. And Senator Gillibrand, one of the senators here from New York, one of the two senators, introduced a piece of legislation called the Family Support Services for Addiction Act, which was money for families who have loved ones suffering from substance use disorder, you know, peer support groups, coaching, what we call systems navigation here, which is, you know, helping individuals navigate the complicated path of a rehab and how to deal with insurance companies and so forth. When I was invited to this press conference, I was just an observer. But unbeknownst to me, the senator pulled me out of the audience to tell my story. I had no idea this was happening. And I did that, as I'm doing with you. It was an abbreviated version. And the next thing I know is that the press is there and television is there. And I start, you know, being quoted in publications in Washington. And they did actually an article on me in the National Review about the COVID-19 and its effects on treatment for the opioid epidemic. And at that point, Donald, I said, you know what? Let's take, for example, most people around the world don't know that Donald Trump lost his brother to alcoholism. Okay, this is not a political statement by any means, but people don't know around the world that the billions of dollars this country is spending on addressing this epidemic. They don't know, for example, that Congressman Trone recently created the bipartisan task force of addiction and mental health. Wouldn't it be great if other countries knew all the things we were doing, the positive things, and that's why we need the media? And so I said, you know what, there were no real advocates in this country doing it. And so I took it upon myself to bring my advocacy to an international level. And I wrote an op-ed about this story in the Jerusalem Post, and I wrote something about stigma. I authored an article in the Shingetsu News Agency, and I did something on CTV about the pharma settlement, the Purdue pharma settlement on Canadian television. And I'm with you, and there was something on Australia radio, and it's taken on a life of its own. And God, and I say that in something bigger than myself, not in a religious sense, has said, hey, you want to take a ride? And I said, no, I'm too busy. And he said, well, F you, you're taking a ride. and here's where you, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse. I don't want to break any FCC rules, what we have here, you know, FCC. And here's what I've arrived at. And I don't make any money doing this. I've never been happier in my life. I'm an entrepreneur. I've had successful businesses. But at the end of the day, Giles, if I survived 11 emergency rooms and my daughter survived, would have certainly been an overdose. And we have a happy, wonderful life and a wonderful relationship. I feel an obligation to go out into the media, let people know about the successes in recovery, the tools that they can use to address, and more than anything, for parents to have a loving, destigmatized conversation with their child and say what we said, hopefully, and do their research and know what's out there for them. And when their child sees that there's a genuine effort on their parents' part to really help them, they react differently. They react from a place of love. And also, in the mind of someone suffering, you know, trying to get well, it's one less excuse, because my daughter would say, I didn't have a childhood, I had a victimhood. She's going to blame her parents for her lot in life. But when we have this conversation, she says, no, I can't blame them anymore. They're really trying to help me. It makes her look at her own situation, take more ownership of it, and in the case of my daughter, go and get the help that she needed. And there are success stories, and there are wonderful shows like this and individuals like yourself that will give us the airtime. And I'm telling you, so when I did that press conference, and I'll close with this, I had three parents call me, because I put out, and you can do this too, I put out my email address, I put out my phone call. If someone has questions, give me a call. I will speak to them. If they're in the area, you know, pre-COVID, I will sit down with them and have coffee, even now, you know, wearing a mask, because this is life and death. And I want them to know about everything that's going on to address what we call here in the United States a public health emergency. I mean, we lost 81,000 individuals last year. That's more than we lost in the entire Vietnam War. So this is no joke. The fact that you're airing this, in addition to the individuals, is bringing awareness that you know, things may be stable now. Certainly Spain and the United States are different animals. But, you know, the pharmaceutical companies are not going anywhere. The drug traffickers are not going anywhere. And given that there's probably going to be a lot of post-traumatic stress syndrome from COVID, many people will turn to substances, you know, to alleviate that pain. And my prediction, and I'm not a doctor practicing without a license, is that the drug use is going to get worse all over the world. And so I hope I'm contributing, you know, my little piece of advocacy and helping. If I help, I always say, if I help one person get well or one family heal, because this is a family disease, then I've done my part.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because people in active addiction tend to think that they are the only one. They are different. I am unique. It's killing me, but I am unique. And if you are suffering and an addict, you don't see the damage that you do to the people who love you. And therefore, taking that family view, as you did with your daughter, it is a massive step.
It really was. It was a turning point in our lives and a turning point for her. And I qualify and they say, in no way do I take responsibility for her sobriety and her decisions. But she will share with you that conversation was a game changer for her. And that's because we destigmatized it. You know, we loved our daughter. We made sure we knew that. And that she absolutely said she had no more excuses. And she said, I'm looking at my parents. I'm looking at a drug dealing boyfriend. Who should I be believing here? And she got it. You know what I mean? So we call those in the 12-step program white light moments and turning points. And you know, the bottom line, the root cause guiles of the epidemic is stigma. Stigma is the absence of compassion. And when you change the language and you have these conversations, you destigmatize people's opinions about someone's suffering. Most people, you know, everyone that comes into this has a biased opinion about, you know, substance use disorder and the individuals. And most of them believe, they stigmatize it, that it's an individual that is a criminal and a loser and no asset to society. So I believe that I always want to qualify my wife as well. She's not in recovery, but she was right, you know, right there, my co-pilot. And thank God, Giles, that, you know, it had a happy ending. We see in our 12-step programs, I go to meetings every day, parents that have gotten that call from the coroner's office, and it shakes me up, because that could have been me. I always say, I did lose my daughter, but I got her back. But I could have gotten that call, and I know many parents that have.
And you talked about the Portugal program. I mean, it is very, which is a a different way of looking at them, treating it as a health emergency. It is very easy for, if you like, populist politicians or politicians who don't get that this is a disease to come down, you know, tough on drugs and say exactly what you said before, you know, drug users or anybody who abuses any substance is a loser, is a criminal. And of course, as we know, addiction isn't like that. It's not the guy on Skid Row. It's not the, you know, the girl holed up in an apartment. It's you know, people suffering from this walk among us and just about hold down regular jobs.
Absolutely, Giles, and you make a very good point. That's why, and Portugal didn't do this last week. They did this, I think it was 10 years ago. There was an individual there, and it escapes my name, and he really did a groundbreaking thing. He understood what you just said, and he said, look, we need to treat our citizens with compassion. Let's get this out of them. Let's stop punishing, trying to punish this program away. And let's put this in our Ministry of Health and treat it like it is what it is. It's an illness. And they did that. They took this bold move. They decriminalized possession of drugs for a 10-day or less supply. So we're not talking about drug traffickers or these very evil people that are killing people. We're talking about, you know, the drug user who wants to medicate themselves. And they did that, and they created the dissuasion committee, and they gave them harm reduction tools. And even going one step further, when you know, and this is really controversial, right, the safe injection sites. So you have a committee saying, listen, if you're not ready to stop using or go to a facility, okay, we still are with you. Here's where you go to safely use. Now, you think about how bold that is. You know, where are you going to put a safe injection site? But those are becoming more popular, and it's becoming part of the conversation because you're saying to that person suffering, we love you, we want you to be safe. And so what happened? What was the end result? They reversed their epidemic by 75%. And so, but are you going to get these politicians to do what they did? Of course not, because this constituent says, what are you doing? You know, you're decriminalizing this. You're spending our resources on these losers, on these criminals. And so it was such a bold move, but it created this wonderful model that all of us can follow. And it's right in line with my message. And it's right in line with the questions you're asking me, Giles, because it's always a pleasure to speak to someone that gets it. Not that it's not valuable to speak to someone that doesn't get it. In fact, they're more important. But when someone understands what I'm saying, it's just a little, it's like a little mini victory for me. You know what I mean? It brings a smile to my face.
We talk about, there's a lot of talk about isolation. And one of the things that's, people suffering from addiction will often try and isolate to hide from people, to get away from the world, to escape the world. The current situation, the pandemic, means that a lot of us had been forced to isolate. What sort of impact does that have on somebody perhaps just coming into recovery who can't go to those physical meetings and perhaps sees this as an indication, as a green light, if you like, to keep using their drug of choice?
Right, that's another great question. Thank you for that, Giles. The pandemic has had a devastating effect on those seeking recovery. When you go back to the beginning of the pandemic, someone suffering from substance use disorder will use any excuse to not get the help they can, right? They have to hit that. They have to reach that jumping off place. That's terminology we use in a 12-step program. I don't mean that in a suicidal way. They have to be finished. They have to want to get well more than they want to get high. They, you know, they come into the place where they're in the hallway. Alcohol is their best friend. Alcohol is their worst enemy. So what happened was when you had COVID and it was rampant, you know, someone suffering from SUD is not going to go to the hospital, right? Because they don't want to catch COVID. In addition, the beds were being converted to COVID beds, so they weren't beds anyway, and there wasn't room really in rehabs, inpatient rehabs, because when someone new went in, they had to quarantine them, and that would take up, let's say, the entire space of the dorm or the room, as opposed to where they could put two or three. So they would lose what we call square footage. Then you have the elderly that are dying in droves, so you have all the trauma and stress that the young adults are experiencing with that. And then what I think is the most critical is, and I subscribe to a 12-step abstinence-based program, which is the biggest recovery, you know, source in the world. Well, all those in-person meetings got shut down. They're only starting to come back here in New York. In fact, in New York City, most of them are still shut down. Here in Long Island, they have opened up, but in other areas, they're just coming around. So what people do as an alternative is they do the virtual meetings. Well, you're not really accountable behind a computer screen. Someone can't look at you and say, you know, what's the problem? Or sit down, or let's have a cup of coffee. So the virtual meetings are great in the sense that it's better than nothing, but it has really damaged someone, especially that's detoxing and coming out of rehab, that has to now sit behind a computer. Well, I could sit behind a computer and do a Zoom meeting, and then I could lean to my left and snort cocaine or chop up, you know, a Percocet or a Vicodin or an Oxy. So it's had a devastating effect, but they are starting to open up. Then you just have the simple fact that people just put $1,400 in their pocket with a stimulus check. The worst thing you can do is give someone suffering from an addiction money. And so you have all of these different things going on. And in a nutshell, to answer your question, Giles, it has had a devastating effect. That's why overdoses are way up. I belong to a heroin prevention task force with the district attorney's office out here, and we get the raw numbers. And then we can go on a sidebar and talk about Narcan and the fact that if people carried Narcan, which is a nasal administrator, which reverses, you know, the breathing that stops from an overdose, we would improve the numbers. But that's a whole nother, you know, controversy for another discussion. But the bottom line is, to answer your question, is that COVID has had a devastating effect on those seeking recovery and is going to have an effect for a long time. The numbers are up, and it's hard enough. In our 12-step program, and I'm not a statistician, Giles, but for every 10 people that come through the door to try to get help, 8 walk out the door. So you have a 20% success rate before the pandemic. Well, with the pandemic, why don't you just cut that number in half? And we see it. We see it. We go to our meetings. What happened to so-and-so? Where's so-and-so? They disappeared. They're not coming. They don't answer the phone. And the next thing you know, read the obituary, or there's, you know, there's another funeral, there's another wake. And it's a recipe for disaster.
I suppose, I mean, one of the things is, if I get it correctly, some of the tools you're given is just taking a day at a time. Don't think the big picture, because that will completely sort of overwhelm you. Perhaps taking it one day at a time in a time of COVID, when everybody's got anxiety, everybody doesn't know how they're going to get through the month. Perhaps just keeping it for 24 hours or even 12 hours is a tool we can all use.
Yes, that is a slogan, of which there are many, from the 12-step program that you know of. I just prefer to not use the name because it's an anonymous program. You know, you're welcome to if you like, but I'm sure it's very popular out there. But one of the most powerful slogans is one day at a time. And what we mean is, you know, yesterday's history, tomorrow's a mystery. So they say, look at where your feet are. Focus on this 24 hours. What is your plan today to not drink? You know, the most important thing I can do today, Giles, more than see my daughter, more than make money, is to not pick up that first shot of tequila, not pick up that first Oxy. And in your case, by the way, Spain is very different. It's very interesting because the culprit right now is fentanyl. But the fentanyl on the streets, which is trafficked in from China and Mexico, is being cut into the street drug. So it's being cut into everything. Not just heroin, but opiates, even cocaine. Fentanyl is a big problem in Spain, but you have the immediate release fentanyl that is being used widely, and that's really on the rise in Spain. So the one day at a time, yeah, it's like, let's slow down. Let's have a plan for today. Did you get to your 12-step meeting? Did you talk to your support group? If you're a religious program, did you sprinkle a little prayer in there? Did you do some service? Did you help somebody else? What tools did you use today to keep yourself awake, to keep yourself sober? And yes, that's a very big thing, because those suffering from this illness project all the time, and it is never good. You know, I'm going to end up like this. I'm going to end up broke. I'm going to end up sick. And if you live in the day, really the opposite happens. The unexpected happens. So
what are you advocating then to governments, to organizations? I mean, should we be, if you like, you know, saddling up our wagons, getting our, you know, getting everything ship shape to head out there once, you know, the situation is clear? Because obviously there's going to be a lot of people out there who are going to need a lot of immediate and perhaps quite, if they so choose, drastic aid.
Right. So as a, you know, my advocacy work takes two tracks. One is doing this, speaking in the media, and the other is working with legislators in Washington to understand what they're doing, align with them, and then speak in the media about it. So there really is, when you first talk about congressmen, when you talk about senators in our U.S. Congress, and I'd like to work with other legislators in other countries, and that's my next frontier. The first and foremost is awareness. We want them to let our citizens know that it is top of mind. It's not something that's being brushed under the rug, and that they are very keenly aware of how serious this disease is and how it's rampant in this country. So the gentleman that's the leading individual in Congress, his name is David Trone. And for example, a month ago, he formed the bipartisan Addiction and Mental Health Task Force. So this is a large group of the bipartisan, so it's Democrats and Republicans, who are on a committee, who draft bills, who have task forces, who make recommendations to the president or the, you know, the Opioid Epidemic Drug Policy Commission that we have here. And so, and they fund. And they give the monies, and they give block grants to individuals, to organizations that then disseminate those millions of dollars to other community-based organizations. So the legislators are key because, you know, and then what happens is when they're passing bills, when they're distributing the funds, that's more topic for me to discuss. And so going back to my first press conference, he introduced, along with Senator Gillibrand, the Family Support Services for Addiction Act. Oh, what's that? $25 million over 5 years for services for families. Oh, well, let's let the public know. Let's let them know to go on the website. Let's let them know there are funds and support groups and coaching and navigation in rehabs. Let's let them know. So it's awareness, it's funding. And it's a comfort zone letting citizens know that this is being addressed in our government. And that's huge. It's not being brushed under the rug like it used to be. You know, years ago, President Nixon, he declared the war on drugs because we're criminals. We're animals. We're the street people. It's not a war, you see. And so the government is coming from a place of funding and of open discussion. And that's part of the healing process. So, and I'm really excited to say there is so much happening. Telehealth is really, really, there's a lot of funding for telehealth. The lawsuits and the settlements with, you know, Purdue Pharma and McKesson and all the opioid manufacturers and distributors has taken money, billions of dollars, and now put that into treatment. There's a lot of good things that are coming up, and my job as an advocate is to get that out there and disseminate that information.
If people want to find more information about you online, get in contact with you, where can they go, Robert?
The best thing to do is for them to email me. And what I can do is I can send what I sent to you, which is a current press release of everything I've done with my contact information. And like I said, anyone that wants to email me, I will direct them to the appropriate resources, and I will speak with them, and they are welcome to call me. I have no problem. What's the worst that's going to happen, Giles? I hang up the phone. But if I have one conversation that saves a life, it will be worth 20 hangups, you know what I mean, or 20 angry listeners, or 20 listeners that still have that stigma. If they are on LinkedIn, social media, they can go to my LinkedIn profile, which has a ton of information. And those are the best ways that they can reach me.
If somebody's out there listening, they may be, you know, somebody on their own, or it might be a concerned parent or a concerned work colleague or a partner or something. What would you advise just as a first step? Because there is stigma attached to this. from governments, from organizations, from individuals. So what would your first step be for advice if somebody thinks they may need to talk?
Are you talking about the individual or the family?
Either or. We'll start with the individual, then go to the family, shall we?
So the individual what should the individual do? If it was me, and it was me, I would be going online and I would be looking at the 12-step meeting schedules. And these 12-step meetings are free. And I would do my best to get to that meeting, sit in the back, stand in the back, and you raise a hand and say, this is my first meeting. I don't know anything about anything, but I'm suffering from, you know, drinking alcohol too much and my life has become unbearable and I'm here and that's it. To replace the fear with the faith. There are many pathways to recovery. You can contact your physician and have an open, honest conversation with them, and they will possibly prescribe Suboxone, methadone. It's called medication-assisted treatment. There are fellowships out there that advocate for moderation, not abstinence. And that one happens to be here called Smart Recovery. The one that I subscribe to, the largest in the world, is an anonymous program. But if somebody Googles a 12-step anonymous abstinence-based program meetings, they're going to figure out what I'm talking about. I would get my ass to one of those meetings. Also, there are hotlines and nonprofit agencies that have hotlines and coaching services. If someone's not ready to take that bold step, and it is a bold step, right, they can pick up the phone. I want to see someone that's suffering get it onto their desk and start Googling and arm themselves with information. The parents need to do the same things. Once they have a better grasp on the illness and the resources out there, they can start having these conversations. I want those suffering to understand there are a tremendous amount of resources to help them. There are a tremendous amount of people that want them to get well. Take that first step. You know, get on your computer, start Googling, start researching, just make a few phone calls. That's all you have to do. If you want, speak to your doctor. If you want, most people in this country are touched by substance use disorder, opiate use disorder. Speak to someone you know that is in recovery. They will absolutely help you. Just take that first step and let live in the day, like you said, and let your path move forward to recovery.
Difficult decisions. These are difficult times, but there is a way out. Robert Cantor, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
An honor and a privilege, Giles, and thank you again.